right, open your Bible to Judges chapter 7. Judges chapter 7. Let me first read in Judges chapter 8, verse 22. It says, "Then the men of Israel said unto Gideon, Rule thou over us, both thou and thy son, and thy son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian." If you know the story of Gideon, and I like the story of Gideon, it's one of our favorite stories. So we like preaching on it. In Sunday school, you hear the story of Gideon. And this is Wednesday night, and so I know most of you here already know the story of Gideon. And we usually end the story in chapter 7, verse 22. The 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man sword against his fellow, even throughout all the host, and the host fled. And there's this great victory over the Midianites, this huge army. And, of course, just with these few men, that 300 men that Gideon had, God gives them a huge victory. And, of course, leading up to that are all the stories early on of Gideon having to smash the idol that his father made and then trying to build his faith in God and asking God for signs and that sort of thing. And we know that story, and we usually end in chapter 7, verse 22. But the story of Gideon goes on for another chapter and a half. And then there's more chapters after that of what happens to the rest of Gideon's family. There's a lot more that happens after the great victory, after the Sunday school story is over. There's a whole bunch of little stories in there. And you don't often hear a message on them. We usually stop right there. So tonight, I want to preach a message called After the Victory. And we're going to start in verse 24. The verse after we usually end. I want to start there and walk through this passage, the things that happen after Gideon gets this enormous victory from God. And I think, well, that's the end of the story. It's the happily ever after. But it turns out that's the beginning of the story. And the decisions Gideon makes in these next two pages of your Bible are some of the most important decisions he makes in his entire life. And they set the course for Israel going forward. Good decisions and bad decisions. And we see different people in Israel making wise and foolish decisions and facing the consequences, and we can learn a lot from that. And here's why it's important. We serve a God who answers prayer. We serve a God who heals diseases. We serve a God who helps families put things back together. We serve a God who grows churches, who wins souls. We serve a God who gives lasting victory over stubborn habits of sin. That's the God we serve. And so if you serve God for very long, you're going to experience some victories in your life. If you serve God for long, you realize that sometimes our biggest mistakes happen right after our biggest victories. Churches struggle and have church splits right after they finish building a building. I don't know, that might have happened in this building at some time in the past before Pastor Walsh was here. But that's the kind of thing that happens. Families solve some big crisis, and then sin enters in and new crisis starts. Sometimes we can make our biggest regrets right after our biggest wins. What we do after a great victory is really important. How I respond to God doing a great work in my life or in the lives of others around me, it matters a whole lot. So what do we need to do after a victory? Tonight, as we walk through this passage, we're going to see eight things, eight principles that are going to help us. I want you to remember that we can learn from the stories of Gideon at the end of the story that we usually skip. So let's start in verse 24, Judges chapter 7, verse 24. So the enemy army runs, right? Verse 23. We start verse 23. It says, "And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali and out of Asher and out of all Manasseh and pursued after the Midianites." So Gideon had 300 men. And as soon as the enemy army starts to run, here come everybody else. Now, some of these men had previously joined Gideon's army, and they went home because they were scared, or Gideon sent them home. But now they see the victory is happening. Hey, I want part of that, and they come back. And who knows how many others that were too cowardly to come when Gideon first blew the trumpet, they're coming now. These are the three tribes that were surrounding the Jezreel Valley there where the battle took place, where the Midianites were. These were the initial people involved in this whole issue with the Midianites. And so they're coming. They've been hiding up in the mountains, hiding in their caves, trying to not have their stuff stolen by the Midianites. And now they see that God is winning. And they come out. They want a part of that victory. And then it says this, and Gideon sent messengers throughout all Mount Ephraim, saying, so now this is the big tribe to the south. They weren't involved here at all so far in the story. But Ephraim is the most powerful tribe, other than possibly Judah, which is even further south. They're not even any part of the story at all. But Ephraim is the tribe that's supposed to be the leaders of Israel. The tabernacle is there. The Joshua was from Ephraim. Israel made Joseph's youngest son. Remember, Joseph has been promoted to the eldest son. Reuben, who was the eldest, has been demoted. This is when before Jacob died, lost his birthright as the firstborn because he committed a horrendous immoral act. And so Jacob made Joseph, second to the youngest son, gave him the position of firstborn. And then amongst his two sons, who he adopted, not as grandsons, but as sons, giving them the position now as tribes, even though they would technically be a half-tribe, it's all part of the tribe of Joseph. And then when he went to bless, he crossed his arms over. You remember the story way back in Genesis? This is, I got to remember this. That's way back there, right? Yeah, remember he put his right hand on the younger son, Ephraim, and his left hand on Manasseh, and he did that on purpose. And Joseph, hey, hold on, this is the first one. No, I know what I'm doing. And he prophesied, he gave Ephraim the position of firstborn. So they're considered, the people, men of Ephraim, they consider themselves in charge, especially over Manasseh, right, Ephraim's brother, but also over all Israel. They're the important tribe, and they're the powerful tribe, and so forth. If you look at the numbers coming out of when they come out of Egypt, the tribe of Joseph is the largest, Judah the second largest, but if you split up Ephraim and Manasseh, Judah's a little larger, but yeah, amongst them, Ephraim's one of the largest, the strongest tribes of Israel. So now he sends messengers down to Ephraim because the enemy army is running. He's got to pursue after this army. Although he's defeated them there, the kings and the princes and the rulers are still alive. If they escape, they're going to regroup and they're going to come back at them the next year and do more damage. And this time they're going to come back with a vengeance and just destroy everything. So they've got to chase them down and get a permanent victory. That's what this is all, everything that's happening here is about that. And so he sends messengers, verse 24, throughout all Mount Ephraim, saying, come down against the Midianites. Come down. So Gideon lived in the valley. That's where the Midianites were. They had come to where Gideon was in the valley, the Jezreel Valley up north. And then down south of them was Mount Ephraim, way up in the mountains. So the Ephraimites, they were kind of high and dry. The chariots and camels that the Midianites had really couldn't run up hills very well. So they were a huge threat to Gideon and his family. And we'll find out in a minute, many of Gideon's family had already been murdered by them. But the men of Ephraim, they were just, it's kind of their problem, not our problem. If we go down and get involved, we're going to get killed. But if we just stay right here, they're not going to bother us because we're way up here in the mountains. But now he sends a messenger to Mount Ephraim saying, come down against the Midianites and take them before the waters of Beth-Bereth and Jordan. So before they can cross over the river, take the river forge first and block them off, and we'll be able to get them. They won't escape. So he sends these, probably some really fast running guy, or someone that can really sprint. You run ahead and try to tell the people of Ephraim to cut off this army and get ahead of them and block them and keep them from escaping. Then the men of all the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and took the waters of Beth-Bereth and Jordan. So they go, they block off the escape of this enemy army. So they're helping stuff. And by doing that, they did a lot more damage than Gideon's 300 men could do. And they took the two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb, and slew Oreb on the rock Oreb, and Zeb he slew at the wine press of Zeb. If you're wondering why they happened to die at a place named after them, that was named after they died there. So this is known the time when Judges is being written. Everybody knows about the location of the rock Oreb and the winepress of Zeb, and the writer of the book of Judges is saying, hey, this is why we call it the winepress of Zeb, because that's where they slew Zeb, and this is why they call it the rock of Oreb, because that's where they killed Oreb. So this, by this rock and in this winepress, they get the two princes of the Midianites as they're escaping. And they pursued Midian. They didn't get everybody, but they pursued them. And so they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gibeon on the other side of Jordan. So they run and chase them across Jordan. And hey, we got these two guys. They tried to escape. We got the two princes, right? So here's the deal. It was just 300 men, and they experienced victory. And now all across Israel, they're experiencing victory over their enemies. So here's our first principle. Principle number one, when we experience spiritual victory, others will as well. So why is that important? When we experience spiritual victory, others will as well. It's sometimes discouraging. We keep trying to serve the Lord. We keep trying to do what's right, and we face defeat, and we try to go. Sometimes the devil can convince us it's not worth it. When it comes to just victory in your family, say, hey, my kids are already grown. You know what? I'm too far gone. I've made my bad decisions, and nothing I'm going to do at this point is going to turn around and undo the bad decisions I made in my life. What's the point of seeking God's victory in my life now? And the answer is, it's not about you. No matter who you are, no matter how much it's worth it in your life, when you get right with God and experience spiritual victory, it's going to impact those around you. And others will seek God, and they will see spiritual victory. Just as Gideon's men, trusting God, they saw a victory. Pretty soon, everyone else came, and they were defeating Midianites left and right. So that's principle number one. Now, as we go to chapter 8, verse 1, it says this. Judges 8, 1. And the men of Ephraim, so they killed these two princes. They came out to help at the last second, and then they come to Gideon. Oh, here's the heads of these bad guys, right? And the men of Ephraim said unto him, why hast thou served us thus? They're complaining. This is the complaint. That thou callest us not when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites. Now, they don't know the whole backstory that he called a lot of people that he sent back home. So if he had called them, God would have just sent them back home anyway. He only needed 300 guys. Fact of the matter is, he called God, and that's all he needed. He didn't need Ephraim. He just needed God. And so, of course he didn't. But they're complaining that they weren't called, and they didn't get the glory of doing that battle themselves, right? It says, why didn't you call us when we went out to the Midianites? And they did chide with him sharply. Now, if you read through the book of Judges and the Kings, you start realizing this is a long-running complaint and a feud. The whole thing about the Ephraimites, they thought they're supposed to be in charge, and they're supposed to be the boss, and they get very upset when someone else does something without asking them first. And so here they are, they're proud, they're the best. I mean, we're especially if it's someone like Gideon, and Gideon was from Manasseh, right? That's the other brother, right? That's the other half of the tribe. You are technically, okay, in Ephraim's mind, no, you don't understand. It's just the tribe of Joseph. So the elders of Ephraim, they're the elders of the tribe of Joseph. So you didn't even get your own tribe's permission. You're renegades of our tribe. That's how they referred to them later, right? So there's this big issue the Ephraimites always have whenever someone tries to do something without their permission. It's a plot throughout a lot of the Bible. That's ultimately what led to Jeroboam, who was the elder, the leader of the tribe of Joseph, rebelling against the house of David and splitting off Israel as a separate kingdom. It all tied back to this, all the way back through, right? Going all the way back to when Jacob put his hand on Ephraim's head, right? So it's a big deal in the Bible. Back to them, it was a really big deal. To us, we kind of laugh at it, right? But they were so upset. Why didn't you tell us? You should have told us first. We should have been here. We should have been leading the charge. You know, we're supposed to get the credit. So that's a wrong response, right? So here's our second principle. Beware of envy when God gives others victory. So understand from the perspective of Gideon's men, hey, they had a great victory. And hey, great, these other people are having a victory too. But now imagine you're the other people. Hey, they're having a great victory over there. Now, I benefit from it. I mean, after all, they're my enemies. But man, I wish I could have been one of Gideon's 300. I wish I could have been there, and they're all going to come back as heroes. Everybody's going to be, you know, asking them to tell their story, and I wasn't there. I missed out. So I ask you, what is your response when God pours blessing on someone else, not you? Someone answers someone else's prayer before he answers your prayer. When God is doing something great through someone else, and you've been striving for years and asking God to do something great through your life, and then you see God using someone else more than he uses you. Second principle, beware of envy when God gives others victory. So that's important after victory. Let's continue. In verse 2, it says this, and he said unto them, so this is Gideon's response. A very wise response. What have I done now in comparison to you? Notice his tone of voice here. I did a little skirmish at the start with my 300 men. But you guys did the real fighting here. My accomplishments are nothing compared to your accomplishments. He says, is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? What is he saying? Abiezer, that's his own family group. That's his hometown, right? He's saying, like, the leftovers on your vines after you harvest your grapes, that's better than the stuff that we harvest on our grapes as our main harvest, right? Like, you accomplish so much more. I'm nothing in compared to you. That seems like an exaggeration. I mean, Gideon just wiped out a massive army with 300 men. I mean, what he's doing, he's being humble. He's letting them take the credit for his victory. It says, God hath delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. And what was I able to do in comparison to you? Look, I tried, but they got away from me, but you got them. Right? Look what he's doing here. He's totally not trying to take any of the credit for himself. He's allowing them, the envious bunch, to take a credit for his victory. Why? Look at the next sentence. Then their anger was abated towards him when he said that. The Bible says a soft answer turneth away wrath. Where did that answer come from? What is that? It's called humility. So our third principle tonight, humility prevents unnecessary conflict. After God does great things in a church, we're exhausted, we're tired, we're burnt out. Some of us are exhilarated. Some of us are envious. It's really easy to start in conflict. Like I said, churches have split after God did something great in that church. Look at Paul and Barnabas right after they finished their first missionary journey. They got in an argument and split up. Like, and that's Paul and Barnabas. Right there, it's really easy for us within a family, within a church, within our close friends in Christ, to have totally unnecessary conflict. So we ask the question, what if Gideon had answered differently? What if he just told them the truth? The truth was, the Midianites were there for 7 years, and Ephraim did nothing about it. 7 years. And the supposed great heroes of Israel sat back and didn't lift a finger. It's all, Ephraim has nothing to complain about. Gideon has every reason to complain. Look, Ephraim had the Ark of the Covenant. They could have blown the trumpet and gotten all of Israel together, marched down with the Ark of the Covenant, asking God for strength and power, and just wiped out those Midianites. They could have done that years before. But they didn't. Gideon could have said it like it was. Hey, look, what are you complaining about? You were cowards. You were wimps. The 300 men, we had the courage to trust God, and God did something great. It would have been 100% true. But what would have happened? In this case, we don't have to wonder what would happen, because later in the book of Judges, it happened. If you turn to chapter 12, you'll see that exact scenario playing out. Another judge, this time Jephthah, and Jephthah, he goes, he has a victory, but he's not as humble or diplomatic as Gideon. And the exact same, well, of course, this is generations later, but the Ephraimites come to him and say, hey, why didn't you tell us before you went over there to fight the Amalekites, right? Hey, you should have told us first. It's the same complaint. And you know what Jephthah does? He says it like it is. He says, look, hey, I put my life in my hands, 12 verse 3, he says, when I passed against the children of Ammon, and the Lord delivered me in my hands. Wherefore, when are you come out this day to fight against me? Hey, where were you? Why didn't you help? He says, we had great strife, back in verse 2, it says, and when I called you, ye delivered me not out of their hands. Hey, we asked you for help, and you didn't help. He just said it like it is. No, he was telling them the truth. He wasn't wrong in what he said. It was completely truthful. But it wasn't quite as humble as what Gideon said. You know what the Ephraimites did in response? They attacked him. They started a civil war. One of the most tragic moments in Israel's history, brother fighting brother. The children of Israel pointlessly. I mean, it's the most, you read the story in chapter 12, it's like, why did that happen? For no reason at all, after God gave a great spiritual victory and defeated Israel's enemies, then Israel goes and starts fighting itself. And it's hard to imagine. But there along the Jordan River, there are piles of bodies. You go down there, it says, and there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000. The strength of Israel was wiped out. Needless conflict. Pointless conflict. These piles of bodies sitting here. I mean, this is fathers and sons and grandfathers. Their children back home in Mount Ephraim that will never see their fathers again. Their wives that will never see their husbands again. Because of why? Some pride? Some envy? But in Gideon's generation, that was all avoided by a little bit of humility. Even though it would have been completely true for him to say, hey, it's not my fault you didn't take care of the Midianites. He didn't say that. He downplayed his own, and he said, he let them take all the credit for Gideon's victory. Of course, it was God's victory. But I mean, Gideon was there. He faced a multitude with 300 men. If he was wrong that day, and he would have been dead in a second. But he let, I tried. I failed to kill those princes, but you guys got them. Humility. If we don't have it after God does some great work, we'll fall to infighting amongst ourselves and limit what God could do with us. So that's principle number 3. Let's continue. Verse 4, and Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, look at this, faint yet pursuing them. He's tired, he's exhausted, he's burnt out, but he's still going. Why? Because if you know the concept here, if he lets them get away, there's still two kings. He killed the princes, but there's still two kings. Right? He lets them get away. They're going to go back to Midian. They're going to regroup. They're going to recruit more soldiers. They're not going to let themselves be defeated. That's a huge blow to their status as king. They want to be victorious. Time and time again in the Bible, whenever they get defeated and the king survives, they come back with a bigger army. They would have come back with twice the army. They probably would have used all the money in Midian to hide. They would have, at this point, after that kind of defeat, it wouldn't matter if they bankrupted Midian. They would have hired all the mercenaries in the Middle East to come back at Gideon. It was so important that he had complete victory here. We can't just stop now. So he's working and he's going and he's exhausted. God gave him the victory, but his body is still tired. And they're hungry. And they come by the town of Succoth. And here's the town of Succoth. And he says, give I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalunna, kings of Midian. I'm chasing the kings of Midian. Can you give food to the guys behind me so they have energy to keep going? Right, here's our fourth principle. Spiritual victory can be physically exhausting, so we need to support one another. After someone has gone through something in the church, we have to think of, okay, those who are about to go through something, those who are going through something difficult and they need victory, we know, okay, they're going through surgery, they're going through this, and we bring them food and we help them out. Don't forget someone that things are going great for and God does something great in their life and God is using them. Don't forget that's physically exhausting. Now, Gideon got his power from God, but his body still got tired. And if you see someone working for God, you see a missionary, you see a preacher, you see someone serving here in the church and they're doing something for God. They're relying on God's strength and you pray for God's power to help them reach others. But don't forget, they might have some physical needs and that's what we're here for as a church. Help, encourage one another. And when you see someone going through a hard time, you see someone, they're fighting a great battle in their family. Boy, they're families tonight that are fighting great battles. You know, they were unspoken prayer requests that hands were up. They're fighting battles about their children and grandchildren. They're battles in their family. I mean, there's difficult stuff people are going through that they couldn't even put on the prayer list. You may not know, but sometimes you just see it on their face. This person is exhausted. They've been trying to see God, serving God. God is doing something great in their life, but can I do something to encourage them? Sometimes it's just a smile. Sometimes it's just a moment of thoughtfulness, a hug, a handshake, an encouraging word. Boy, Gideon's men needed a little bit of encouragement from their brothers and sisters right at that moment. But of course, they didn't get it. Verse 6, And the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna, I can't say his name right, I'm going to keep trying, I'm going to butcher it all night here, Zalmunna, now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? What are they saying here? Gideon's saying, hey, God is doing great work, we're winning. Help us out so we can finish off God's enemies. And the men of Succoth said, hold on. Are you sure God's going to win? Oh, I've seen this before. A little bit of victory. You're getting your hopes up, thinking God's going to give us victory. They're going to get away. They're going to recruit an army, and they're going to come back. And if I help you, I'm going to pay. They're going to come back at us. Though God may have given you victory for a day, come on, it's not going to last. In the end, God's going to lose. So we're choosing sides. We're on the sides of the Midians. Look, what they were doing was treason. They basically saying, look, I'm choosing sides. I'm betting on the winner, and I think they're going to win, and God's going to lose. What that was is a lack of faith. Even in the midst of seeing God do a great work. And it wasn't just that. Now Gideon, of course, responds. And Gideon said, wherefore, when the Lord hath delivered Zeba and Zalmunna, he had faith, right, into mine hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. I'm going to teach you guys a lesson. I'm going to whip you with thorn branches. And so he goes to the next town. He went up to Penuel, and he spoke unto them likewise. The men of Penuel answered and said, as the men of Succoth. He answered him, come again in peace. Again, when I, not if I. God's going to give me victory. I'm trusting God. When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. So they were very proud of their tower. He's going to break it down. So if you jump forward to verse 13, you'll see what happens to them. And Gideon, son of Joash, returned from the battle before the sun was up. At verse 14, he catches a man of Succoth, right? So he catches someone, has him describe all the elders of the city so he knows exactly who's responsible. And he comes to Succoth, and he gets him to hand over the leaders. And he goes, and they get vine branches that have thorns on them, and they teach them a lesson. And so he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth, right? So this seems like a reasonable way to teach these guys a lesson for their treachery. He sits there and whips them with thorns, all right? Then verse 17, it says, and he beat down the tower of Penuel, and he slew the men of that city. Now, for whatever reason, the second half of verse 17 seems to be the distraction here. When people read this, they get stuck on the fact that, hey, hold on. He whipped these guys with whips. That seems reasonable. He broke down their tower. That seems reasonable. But then he kills all the men in the city. And people kind of think missing the whole picture here. So I'm going to pause for a second here and deal with this, okay? So it's easy to say, oh, Gideon, you kind of over-responded here, right? I mean, it's a little obsessive. They wouldn't give you bread, so you kill them all. Now, before I pass judgment on Gideon, right, that may be the case, right? That may be what happened here. But I'm not going to judge Gideon so harshly because the fact of the matter is I don't know the whole scenario. Two things we want to note. Number one, he didn't say that he would kill them all. He said, I'll tear down the tower. So it's very possible that he went to the city with the intention of tearing down the tower and not killing a soul. But then the guys got in the tower and said, you're not taking our tower, and start shooting arrows and killing his own men. So in order to tear down the tower, you know, they die defending the tower. They chose to fight against him and start a civil war, and that's the result of them attacking him. So I don't know if that was the case, but that's quite possible. There's a second thing to note here. It talks about this city with a tower. Now, that's an interesting concept. A lot of times you hear cities just have walls, but right at this moment in history, it appears that many cities had a tower, a fortress, within the fortress. So you have a wall to stop the enemy, but then you have another a tower, this inner fortress, like the castles you see in the Middle Ages, where if the enemy is about to breach the wall of the city, the people can run and hide in the tower, or at least the wealthy people, whoever, you know, is of enough importance to fit in there, right? In the fortress within the city, so that they break through the city, they have another obstacle. And so this seems to be this fortress within a fortress idea. Now, the only way you can see another example is in the very next chapter. There's another city that has a tower like this, and it's the city of Shechem. Say, why is that important? Well, in the city of Shechem, it spends more time describing the tower. It's not just a tower fortress. It's also a temple to a false god. And this is actually an important thing, that it's a fortress temple. And in fact, this was actually not just something we read in the Bible. This is a major study of archaeology, because you can actually go to the foundations of that fortress temple today. And so when they first found it, the archaeologists try to claim, well, okay, maybe in the past it was a temple, but it's just a fortress. You know, it was just a fortress. That's all it was. But the Bible said it was also a temple. And of course, the archaeologists tried to deny the Bible. I was actually reading. I have the results of the archaeological study, and finally the argument was finished with this picture right here. You can't really see it, but if you want to look at it, come look at it afterwards. The fortress built in Gideon's time is angled, is rotated. You can't see it super well here, but it's rotated compared to the foundation of the previous temple of Baal that was made during the Canaanite times before Joshua. So what the children of Israel had done in turning away from God had built another temple on top of, in the sacred spot of the temple that the Canaanites used to worship at. So they rebuilt one of the temples of Baal that was either destroyed before or during the invasion of Joshua's time there at Shechem. And there was a big argument forever, oh no, it was just a fortress, the Bible's wrong, until they found the altar and the standing stones. And this diagram is what ended the argument, because in this diagram, they're lined up not with the old earlier Canaanite temple, but they're aligned with that later temple. So it indeed was a temple. It wasn't just a fortress. It was, in fact, a place where they worshipped Baal. And, of course, in the next couple chapters, you'll see it eventually gets destroyed as part of God's judgment on the people there of Shechem. But the point is this. It seems in that time there was a precedent for the tower of a city also being a pagan temple. So what I can't judge Gideon for, like, oh, that's overkill, because it's very possible that this tower here, just as in Shechem, was in fact a place where they worshiped an idol. And that's why you just whipped them with whips. Why did you tear down their tower? Well, if this was actually a pagan temple, which it very well could have been, then he's much more justified in destroying it. And if they choose to fight him, he's justified in killing them. Does that make sense? So that's a little tangent off. So before you sit there judging Gideon so much. But all that is a side note. So I just dealt with that so that we can stop thinking about it. What do we know from this passage? I don't know if Gideon was right or wrong to do this. But what I do absolutely know, that the leaders of these two cities were wrong. They were wrong to not trust God and not help Gideon's men. They committed treason when they said, no, we're siding with the enemy because we think they're going to win. What was the problem? So what's the principle here? Principle number five, beware of pessimism robbing your faith. They had that attitude of pessimism. Oh, come on. In the end, and it's the same thing, it can attack us. We're fighting against sin. We're fighting spiritual warfare. And we're like, yeah, if I get right with God now, I'm just going to mess up again later. So what's the point? It's what the devil will tell you. And that kind of pessimism will cause us not to trust God. Yes, people have turned away from God. Yes, I've made mistakes. But if I'm relying on God for victory, that I don't have to sit there and look at my past record. I can look to God and say, he is able to do it. So when we see that victory. So there it is. Let's continue and finish this up. In verse 8, he deals with this. Our next principle, number 6, is don't be content with partial victory over sin. What happens in verse 10 through 12 of chapter 8 is Gideon continues to pursue those kings, and they go into a place where they're defended. They return to their, and for whatever guidance, maybe it's from God, he finds this route around behind and sneaks up behind them and defeats them. And then they run again, and he's tired by this point, right? He's not slept in 48 hours. But he continues to chase those two kings, and he eventually catches them. And he brings them back. Of course, he deals with the people there. And then he passes judgment on these two kings. In this case, it turns out they confess that they murdered Gideon's brothers. And so he says, I would have let you live, but you murdered my brothers. He commands his son to kill them. He's too young and afraid to. So Gideon finishes the deed and kills both those kings. And it's dealt with completely. And here's the lesson for us as we fight spiritual warfare. Are we content with what little victory God has given us? And we're not continuing to seek more victory over sin? It's so easy to say, hey, well, God has helped me overcome sin some in my life. I'm not doing this really bad thing anymore. So it's okay to do this little sin now? Or are we going to be like Paul, I press towards the mark. I've not yet apprehended. I'm not perfect yet. Even though this is Paul the Apostle after years of ministry, he's more spiritually mature than I likely will ever be. But he said, no, I'm still going. I'm still trying to get closer to God. He had that huge victory over that huge army. 100,000 men were dead. There's 15,000 still sitting there on that hill. But there's still Midianites in his country. And he's not going to stop till it's dealt with. Are you willing to stop before you've fully dealt with sin in your life? Are you content with, well, I've dealt with those big sins, so this little issue isn't so bad? Learn from Gideon in this moment. Don't be content with partial victory over sin. Then we get to verse 22. And the men of Israel said unto Gideon, rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son also. For thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian. Notice they say, you did it. You delivered us from Midian. Did God get deliver? Did Gideon deliver us from the hand of Midian? No, God did. It wasn't Gideon that gave them the victory. God did. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. This is probably the most important moment of Gideon's life, the wisest decision he ever makes. He had an opportunity to be made king. We often talk about in American history, the most critical person in the starting of America is George Washington, because he could have made himself king, and instead he willingly finishes the after two terms, he gives up on the presidency. He doesn't try to run any farther. He says, I'm not going to be king. Well, Gideon says, I'm not going to be king. He knows that's wrong. He knows that's not God's best. He says, the Lord shall rule over you. Here's the principle. In victory, put God first. Listen, it's natural for those around you to give you credit for what God did in your life. How are you going to give credit back to God? You're asking God to do something great. When he does, it's totally normal for everyone to say, wow, you're amazing. And that's the moment you need to give God the glory. So in victory, put God first. Finally, sadly, Gideon doesn't make all good decisions. The very next moment, he he makes the worst decision of his life. And Gideon said unto them, I would desire a request for you. So he says, I'll not be king. That would be wrong for me to be king. Then he's going to say, well, I might as well live like a king. It's not exactly what he says, but he says, well, I do request this, that you would give me every man the earrings of his prey. So here's the thing. They had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So the Midianites were descended from Ishmael, and part of the tradition in that culture was they would wear their wealth on their ears. And at one point further back in Israel, it was a tradition to have their wealth on their daughters' and their wives' ears. And the Ishmaelites, the men, wore golden earrings to show off how rich they were. And also evidently had golden chains on their camels to really show how rich they were. So a small amount of gold has a lot of wealth. So if you had a solid gold earring, that really showed off how wealthy you were. And so that's what they had. And so as you defeated them in battle, guess what? You got gold. So everyone had pockets full of gold after this great victory that God gave them. And Gideon says, hey, can you give me the golden earrings? Oh, sure. I mean, you just saved our country. Absolutely. Here you go. We will willingly give them. And they spread a garment and did cast therein every man his earrings of his prey. And the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold. That is an immense amount of wealth. So he is set for life. Besides ornaments and collars and purple raiment that was on the king of Midian, and besides the chains that were about their camels' necks. So that's a whole other level of... So Gideon is now rich. He's set for life. God blessed him. And God allowed that to happen. They had that, again, the key was they were asking to get rid of the Midianites, but in the midst of that, God blessed them with material wealth. It's a blessing from God. But look what it says in verse 27, it says, and Gideon made an ephod thereof and put it in his city, not God's city, his city, even in Ophrah, and all Israel went thither a whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. So what happens here? What is an ephod? Well, the only reference we have in the Bible is of gold, the garments that the high priest wore. Now he's making this thing out of gold. It may be very different than what the high priest had. I mean, that had stones on it and other kind of things. But he, nonetheless, it's something. So we don't know if it's something that he wore while he did religious things. Maybe he had a priest that wore it. He did make an altar in his hometown after he destroyed his father's altar. Maybe he had his father wear it. I don't know. Maybe it was just there to look at and it was just a opulent thing. But this whole phrase here, he went a whoring after it. That's used a lot in the Old Testament in the context of religion when they went after false gods. So especially in the book of Joshua, they use that phrase, and they went after false gods, false worship, worshiping in a way that was unholy to God. So I really don't know what this ephod was, but I do know two things about it. Number one, God hated it. Number two, everybody else was fine with it. It was horrendous to God, but it was totally normal in that culture. And that wasn't the only thing that he picked up from the culture now that he was rich. In verse 30, it says, and Gideon had 70 sons of his body begotten. Well, that's a lot of sons, for he had many wives. And his concubine, that's not a God concept, that's a world concept, that was in Shechem, she also bare him a son whose name he called Abimelech. So he went to that city that, as I mentioned a second ago, had a tower where they worshipped Baal. He was probably there on official business. After all, it's one of those cities of refuge, Levitical cities, important cities. So as the judge of Israel, of course, he was there on business, probably judging people. But while he was there, guess what he didn't get rid of? The temple where they're collecting money to worship their false god. Money, by the way, that will eventually be used to hire mercenaries to murder all of his family. But while he was there, he obviously did not deal with that. But while he was there, he found a woman that looked pretty and got her pregnant. He did what the world does when you find success and wealth. To us, we say, that's ridiculous. Why would you build, they make this golden ephod and worship it? Why would you have all these wives? But to them in that culture, in that day, that's just what you did when you found success. You see what happened here? He asked God for success, but asked the world what he should do with that success once he had it. He asked God for success, but when God gave it to him, he asked the world around him, what should I do with this blessing from God? And we can so easily do the same. Here's the final principle. Don't let God's blessing get between you and God. That wealth, that prosperity, that being the judge and all the power and everything that came, influence that came with it, that was a blessing from God. But he then let God's blessing get between him and God. See, we're so busy asking God for success, then God blesses us, and I already know what to do with it. We ask God for $1 million, but if I had $1 million, I know what I'm going to do with it. Well, maybe that's why God hasn't given you $1 million. Because if God gives you $1 million, you better ask God what to do with it. But the world has already told you, and we already know. The world has already projected on us, hey, if you ever find success, this is what successful people do. They buy this kind of clothes. They go to that kind of hotel. They go on that kind of cruise and lay on this kind of beach and drive that kind of car. And that's what you do with success. And in his day, you bought an ephod and you had a lot of wives. And that's what you did with success. He never asked God, God, what is this blessing for? That pile of gold, who knows what he could have done with it? Well, probably should have given a bunch of it. You know, he probably should have tithed at least 10% of it to the tabernacle and the sons of Levi that were the priests there, wherever that was at the moment. Who knows what God could have used that blessing to do? But instead, he just assumed, well, if God is blessing me, it must be that he wants me to experience all of that. This importance of doing the right thing when we have success. It reminds me of, in American history, there's a famous poem by Francis Scott Key. You all know it. Well, you know the first part of it, right? Because you see it singing at ball games. But we never get to the end of the song, mostly because it's a long, long poem, and the music we put it to is very slow. So we get through the first verse, and then we say, play ball, right? But if you ever actually read the Star-Spangled Banner down to the end, you'd actually hear the conclusion, which has everything to do with what Gideon is doing here. What do you do once you've been given blessings from God? So Francis Scott Key said this, "And thus be it ever when free man shall stand between their loved home and the war's desolation, blessed with victory and peace, look, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must, for our cause it is just, and this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." We say it again and again, God bless America. But we've never stopped to ask, what are we supposed to do with that blessing once he gives it? We asked God bless America, and he did. He's poured blessing on this nation. And I can say with some historical backing, and it's not an exaggeration to say he's blessed this nation like no other nation that has ever existed on this planet. The wealth, the power, the years of peace and prosperity that we have, it's unparalleled in history. And we keep saying, God bless America. But what are we doing with that blessing? Are we doing with that blessing what God wanted? Why did God bless America? What did he give us that blessing for? And if we don't use it for what God wanted us to use it for, then it's going to happen like it happened to Gideon, and it became a snare. Which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. And the very blessing of God gets between us and God. So here's my challenge. The next time God answers your prayer, God gives you a victory. Something you've been praying about forever, and God finally helps you. God helps you have victory over sin. God deals with something in your family. Stop. Open the book of Judges. Go back to the story of Gideon. Remind yourself of some of these things that you need to do in that moment after God gives you victory.